We're at the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, and our guest today is Marlo Reynolds from the Pembina Institute. Before we actually get into the question period, I just want to remind you to make sure that you do come up to the mic to ask your questions. That way we can ensure that it gets recorded and our videotaping and TV get to hear your question as well as the answer. I'd also like to remind you that there'll be another meeting here next week. Gordon Lee from the John Howard Society will be delivering a presentation called Locked In, Locked Out, How Ignoring the Causes of Crime and Barriers to Reintegration of Ex-Prisoners Hurts Us All. Okay. Marlo can stand up, and if there are any questions to begin our session.
I was just wondering if you could tell the story about the East Slopes and what the landowners are doing to try to stave off the pressures of the oil industry that's trying to destroy their livelihood, etc.
I'm not, as the executive director of the organization, I get to play with a lot of things, but not in enough detail on all these areas. So what I can talk a bit about is, you know, obviously the East Slopes area and the pace of growth on oil and gas development is adding a lot of pressure and a lot of concern. We get a lot of calls and requests for help from landowners. We only have a certain amount of capacity to do that. What I can point people to is a publication, When the Oil Patch Comes to Your Backyard. And if you're not familiar with this and you are a landowner and you have concerns, I think that is a first place to start. It's basically a citizen's guide on knowing your rights and also what questions you should ask and how to negotiate a bit. We are advancing some of this work to a publication that will help landowners deepen their negotiation skills with companies when faced with those big questions. And we talked quite a bit in my talk about oil sands. What we need to remember is that the price of oil has actually just driven an incredible pace on the conventional side as well. I mean, we had 20,000 wells drilled last year in Alberta alone. All of those are on, you know, our vast majority of those are on private land or landowners. So how do you manage that and with this economic boom? So in terms of specifically on the East Slopes, I would point you to Chris Severson Baker from our office, who directs our Energy Watch program and would be able to answer any or help out on some of the detailed questions on that, or point to the oil sands, to the Citizen's Guide on OPATCH. Deeper than that, I don't have a really good answer for you.
Marlo, my name is Sylvia Campbell, and with the increasing concern about climate change, the nuclear industry seems to be in people's minds as a possible solution. I have received several emails from proposals to have a nuclear power plant in Saskatchewan, which would be the oil sands. Could you comment on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nuclear. Actually, this morning on the drive down, CBC had mentioned that there's a proponent oil sands project seeking to get approval for an oil sand or for a nuclear facility in the oil sands, not in Saskatchewan, directly in Alberta, to provide the steam. And I think this will raise an incredible amount of discussion and debate. I think the most important thing is that we do have open debate and discussion on nuclear. There is no doubt, I mean, it's very clear that nuclear is emissions-free from a facility perspective. Upstream, though, there's mining that occurs, and there's emissions associated with that. Now, of course, compared to fossil fuel, it's still very minor. The biggest concern that I think we have to look at on nuclear is obviously the waste side. You know, it, in my mind, is a technology that has just never performed the way it intended or wish it could have. You know, We're quite careful as an organization of, it's no strategic value for us to be anti-something, against something, unless it's very clear against certain criteria. So there's no point in being anti-nuclear, but what I am against is I am against an energy technology that has never performed financially, and with incredible amounts of subsidies to try to make it financially perform. If you know, even just to try to pass the sort of free market test on the energy system, there is no nuclear energy company that would want to bear all the risks associated with the nuclear facility. So the citizens have to basically provide the insurance and the backing, the liability backing. To me, that is not an appropriate part of a sustainable energy solution. We have never managed to deal with the waste. Nuclear power, in terms of volumes of waste, it's not really a lot of waste. I mean, we're talking about, you know, probably a few dozen swimming pools, Olympic-sized swimming pools, for the nuclear waste that we'd have to manage in Canada. But it is the most highly concentrated toxic substance humans have ever created. And we have no means right now of wrestling with that with the current nuclear technology. We also have the whole safety, the proliferation questions around nuclear. And to me, it just sums up, there's just too many unanswered questions with the current technology of nuclear to be able to say that that is where we should be investing our dollars. So that's my comment on the nuclear side. Now, but if I could just link it back to the climate change piece, if we put it into context of what it actually costs for the oil sands to deal with climate change, on a barrel of oil, it's about 65 kilograms to 100 kilograms of carbon dioxide per barrel of oil. Translate that into, if you actually deal with that, it's about $1 to $3 a barrel of oil. At $15 a ton, it's $1 a barrel. At $3 a barrel, you're having to pay about $15 a ton to offset or reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This would be a combination of carbon capture sequestration, in other words, dealing with the emissions on site, and offsetting. So at $1 to $3 a barrel of oil, to eliminate, completely eliminate the carbon problem or the CO2 problem with oil sands, in an economic environment where you have all costs in at $18 to $25 a barrel and market value at $55 to $70 a barrel, is that not enough investment there, a valuable investment for future generations of that $1 to $3 a barrel of oil to completely deal with that challenge? To me, the economics make sense to deal with it that way.
Terry Shillington. Marlo, thank you for your content-rich presentation. I have a twofold question around the water issue. And I may be misquoting Jim Byrne, but I've heard his presentation on water, and I thought he said that the oil companies put out the figure of two to four barrels of water per barrel of oil, but that the real figure was more like seven or so. Now, I may be wrong, but I was sure I heard him challenging corporate figures on that. That's the first question. The second is, could the water not be recycled, and what would be the cost per barrel of that? Mm-hmm.
On the first question, in terms of the actual, where we were relying on numbers provided through industry, through the regulatory process, you know, diving through the environmental impact assessments. And so we've, you know, what we can be actually reference and document is that two to four barrels of water per barrel of oil. It is quite possible that there are certain operations that do require more water, and that might be simply the nature of either the resource that they're working with, if, you know, it's mining, or if it's in situ, in other words, it stays in, they're not doing open pit mining. There's a lot of variables in that. So in terms of you know, we've been working with the 2 to 4 barrels. It wouldn't surprise me if there is a ratio of 1 to 7 on few. We really try to stick to what we can actually reference and document. That's the only way I can answer that question. In terms of managing the water issue, yes, increasing amount of recycling can occur, but you still have this tailings pond challenge where you're basically accumulating that tailings, which has a high water content that needs to settle out. So you can't recycle that water until you actually start settling it out. So there's that challenge. However, from a technical perspective of one of the major things that we've wrestled with and documented and released 2 weeks ago now, a publication called Down to the Last Drop, which looks at, in a deeper depth, the water issues in oil sands, is the in-stream flow needs for the Athabasca, where you have the, you need a minimum amount of water for fish to be viable. There's a pretty easy technical fix there. And it's basically you do water storage. So in times of high water, you put it into storage tanks. In terms of low water, you're able to draw from those tanks. Golder Associates, big engineering company, put a cost on it of about $30 million capital cost, $1 million operating cost. That translates into less than one penny per barrel of oil for 4 months a year. And we cannot put the regulation in place to ensure that it happens. That, for me, is where I kind of wake up and I go, I'm frustrated today. All right, so, this is not about, this is not about full stop, kill oil sands. This is about let's do it right and set an example on how to do it right, because we are going to be measured nationally and internationally on around sustainability on how well we manage the oil sands resource.
My name is James Moore. I've got a couple of questions. It's going to take me a couple of minutes. If you don't mind.
I'll let Sue be the moderator on that.
You were speaking of, to the lack of a national energy policy in Canada. I was wondering, just going to read to you a little bit, but don't we have a default energy policy, which is a energy policy of the United States of America, namely Exxon Oil and things like this? You said Harper, you weren't able to discover anything. Well, probably you were driving down this morning and you missed it, but he's talking about the Hebron field here, and he says that it's a commercial disagreement and he wants nothing to do with it, and he says, we've learned in the past it's best to keep a stable investment climate in the oil and gas business, and that's the general approach the government of Canada will take, and that he thinks it's important that we respect any property rights. He's talking about property rights of Exxon Corporation there, and he's also said, if anybody missed it, in the debate during the election that he was going to enshrine property rights in the Canadian Constitution, and that means Exxon. In contrast to Mr. Harper's statement here, we have in the same paper, but more in the middle, big oil goes with the flow in Chavez's Venezuela, where a large majority of companies are willing to accept tighter terms. Venezuela's large untapped potential reserves, oil prices remain very high. A group of 16 companies converted subcontracting deals to joint ventures, giving state company Petróleos de Venezuela S.A. a majority stake, even after the government imposed tough conditions, including retroactive tax demands, mandatory contract changes. And only Texas-based oil giant Exxon has resisted the Chavez government's orders, selling its stake in a small oil field, blah, blah. So they've walked away. All of the other oil companies are on side. You want to make a comment on government policy and the Harper line, please?
Sure. And this links back for me to the whole picture of we're an emerging energy powerhouse. Sorry, is the mic not on? It's not on. Okay.
Speak right into it.
Perfect. We're emerging as a an energy powerhouse internationally recognized, but we are not consciously thinking about what that means for us. We're not putting, in my mind, a vision in front of us for debate and discussion, a strategy in front of us of how we want to manage our fossil fuel resources and our renewable energy resources. And in terms of the de facto energy policy is get it out of the ground as fast as possible and export it as fast as possible, primarily to the U.S., with an increasing interest of moving it offshore to the Asian markets. Which raises a big question about, for example, the Enbridge Gateway Pipeline. It's a pipeline that is 1,200 kilometers long, going from Fort Saskatchewan to Kitimat. 800 of those 1,200 kilometers is a greenfields project. In other words, a new right-of-way through various habitats. It crosses 40 different First Nations communities or territories. And it's very questionable what the economic benefit of that will be to British Columbians. It opens up the need to release a moratorium on super tanker traffic on the west coast into that Kitimat Strait. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with that area. It's a very beautiful fjord and area there. And so navigating that, that's a sensitive marine environment, and it opens up those questions. And these are the big questions that we're not wrestling with at a federal level or even at a provincial level. What we're also seeing is the subsidies side of it to the energy sector. And again, this is part of the de facto energy policy. Oil and gas sector, when we looked federally, on average over the last decade, is about $1 billion a year in subsidies into the oil and gas sector as a whole. That industry really does not need any handouts right now. Why are we not shifting that towards other, in my mind, building a new economy around a sustainable energy future and incenting that? That's a real opportunity of being able to leverage that resource that way. What did I miss? We can't go back up to the mic. In short, I think, really this